This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What is wellness?
I think of the image of wellness as like pure joy.
The important thing is for people to choose, like, what do you want to do?
Wellness are the things your grandmother told you to do.
When you really start to think about it, the answer feels more complicated. I'm Maya Feller, registered dietitian nutritionist and author.
And I'm Dr. Kavita Patel. We're the hosts of Well Now, Slate's new podcast on wellness.
Join us every Wednesday as we tackle that simple yet important question, what does it mean to be well?
BBC Sounds, music, radio, podcasts.
This is the Woman's Hour podcast.
Hello, good morning to you. My guests today include Lady Glen Connor, who's written a memoir called Lady in Waiting. She worked for Princess Margaret, and boy, does she have some stories to tell, and has she led a life and a half. She'll be on the programme live this morning. We'll talk about a new film, Judy and Punch, which is about domestic abuse, and we'll debunk some of the myths and all the clichés about French women. How is it that all they do is smoke fags, eat loads of carbs and look fantastic? And take lovers well into their 105th year. What is it about the French? What is it about French women on Woman's Hour today? Now, you'll already have heard this morning that another woman has come forward to accuse Jeffrey Epstein of sexually abusing her when she was 15. She also called for Prince Andrew to share what he knows about his former friend. The accountancy firm KPMG has announced it won't renew its sponsorship of the Prince's Pitch at the Palace scheme. And we're also told the prince now regrets not expressing sympathy for Epstein's victims in his interview with the BBC's Newsnight presenter Emily Maitlis. So much of the conversation since that interview has focused on the prince's poor PR advice, his perceived arrogance, and there's been a great deal of merriment, particularly on social media, about the involvement of a Woking branch of Pizza Express. Not for the first time, the victims' voices and experiences are in danger of being somewhat forgotten here. So we thought we'd try to put that right this morning in the company of the journalist and vice chair of Peterborough Rape Crisis and founder of Survivor Stories. That's a website allowing women to share their stories of sexual assault. That's Lizzie Denning. Lizzie, good morning to you. Lizzie, can you hear me?
Good morning.
Yes, thank you. And Madeline Black is with us as well, an activist, author and a survivor of sexual assault. First of all, here is a brief extract from an interview given by the lawyer Gloria Allred. She is representing some of Jeffrey Epstein's victims.
Many of them were very traumatised by what they suffered as a result of coming into contact with Mr. Epstein. And that harm continues today. Mm. So we're filing civil lawsuits. And in addition, the criminal investigation is a serious one and continues. And if there's sufficient evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, I have no doubt that criminal charges then will be filed against others who have conspired with Mr. Epstein. And I also would like Prince Andrew to really feel what these victims have suffered, because I feel in his interview that was broadcast on the BBC that, you know, he seemed to almost, except for Ms. Roberts, not even mention the victims and how much they were harmed. And there are so many of them. They haven't received the whole truth. They haven't received justice. And it's time for him to help.
The lawyer, Gloria Allred. So, Lizzie, the conversation really did move very quickly onto the issues surrounding the interview and the circumstances of the interview, rather than the victim's suffering. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think, sadly, this is quite a common theme at the moment. I mean, I would say that, obviously, it's quite new for the media to have to deal with such a volume of cases like this, which is so high profile. So I think it's sort of feeling its way, and I'm hoping things will improve. But I think I'm not alone in thinking that A lot of the conversation has surrounded specific men of power and how they feel and how it's affected their families. And often what is lost is the stories of the victims. And it's sort of imbuing these men with a secondary form of power, which is over the narrative surrounding their own cases, which is obviously a bit disappointing.
Madeline, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I do believe that when we give the voice to the perpetrators, that we silence women or victims even more. It makes it even harder for them to find their voice.
So what should we do? What should we do now? Programmes like this can have conversations like this, but what about the wider world?
I think it's about listening. It's about being open to people and listening and creating an environment where we're not quick to victim blame. I think a lot of women and men and people of all genders who have been survivors of sexual violence struggle to share their stories, even among their own family and friends, because of certain narratives which are just rife throughout society, such as, you know, were you drinking, what were you wearing, and it's very tedious and, of course, completely irrelevant. And one of the motives behind my website, Survivor Stories, is to create a sort of a pool of these stories, so that eventually, hopefully, it will shut down some victim blaming, because if you've got people of all genders from all backgrounds, then it becomes harder to pin down incidents to particular behaviours or particular appearances.
Madeline, you are a survivor of appalling sexual assault. You are very open and speak out about what happened to you. Why?
Well, it took me a long time to find my voice, but once I found it, I just refused to be silent, because it was a crime that was committed against me, and I don't believe I'm my body or the things that were done to me, but it was the shame that kept me quiet. You know, I thought if people knew what had happened to me, that they would look at me differently or think about me differently or wouldn't even want to know me. But I realise now, it took me ages, but the shame never belonged to me. It always belonged to the perpetrators, that 100% of all rapes is only caused by rapists, nothing else. And I'm not what they did to me, I'm not my body, but I want to speak out to really help to end that shame and the stigma and the silence, and to help other people find their voice. Because every day I will get people messaging me that have heard me speak or read my book and saying, you know, I'd love to like your Instagram page, but I don't want people to guess that I'm liking your page because I've been raped as well. And that's really sad, that the shame is huge for people to carry.
And they keep on carrying it, and that's...
They keep on carrying it.
So the impact of all this publicity surrounding Jeffrey Epstein, Madeline, what is the impact on women like you?
It just angers me, you know, that...
It doesn't make it harder to sleep, for example? Is this constantly on your mind at the moment, you know, or is it always on your mind?
No, I was 13 when I was gang raped, so it's a long time ago, and I'm 54, and I've worked it a lot, so I can really speak and write about it because I am so okay. But, you know, it really just fuels my motivation to speak out more for all the people that can't find their voice.
So the fact that during the course of that interview, and Emily Maitlis did give him the opportunity... Prince Andrew didn't really engage with the suffering of Epstein's victims.
He didn't mention it at all. It was just unbecoming behaviour.
Well, he did at one point, I think, agree, and I think he used the term quite rightly, when Emily Maitlis raised the fact that their voices were now being heard and their stories were being told.
It, you know, often feels too little too late. Are people now speaking out and saying quite rightly, because now they've been associated with this person, you know, it feels... too little, too late. It should have been the first thing. Or it's hard not to get into all the interview. It's not right.
Lizzie?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think it's definitely too little, too late. I would say as well that one of the problems that the media has in general in talking about these issues is it's very keen for survivors to be named and photographed. And while it's incredible to have women like Madeline, who I hugely admire, who are willing to do that, I think often what gets lost is the millions of stories from survivors who, for hundreds of reasons, choose to remain anonymous, which I think is a completely respectable decision. And that's another element to my website, is that I am inviting anyone to share their story, and they don't have to be named, because I think those are particularly the stories that get lost if there's not a kind of a face behind them.
You, I know, also have an issue with language. I think the media is not immune from criticism here. I think even the language used by the BBC sometimes can simply be wrong.
Absolutely. I think any mention of sex in these sort of interviews, I find, makes the hairs on the back of my neck stick up, because sex, of course, implies consent. It is an insult to people who are able to enjoy consensual sex to equate that with rape and trafficking, which could not be further removed. So I think people need to be a bit more astute and a bit more thoughtful, because it's the kind of death of a thousand cuts. Things like that are what trickle down and then stop people sharing their stories, because the word sex implies he said, she said, whereas rape, that's not the case. It's a violent act against a person. Yes, I think accurate terminology is one of my bugbears, certainly.
Madeline?
I totally agree. When you hear sentences like "he forced her to have sex with her," that's forcing someone to have sex, to me, translates as rape. Why can't we just say what it was, that she was raped?
And let's just all of us, certainly those people who engage positively with this programme, remember that there are victims at the heart of this, whatever happens over the coming months. And those victims will have to live with it somehow for the rest of their lives. Thank you both very much indeed for talking to the programme this morning.
You're welcome.
From Madeline Black and from Lizzie Denning, who is a journalist. And she runs Survivor Stories. You can find that website via ours, actually, bbc.co.uk/womanshour, if you'd like to see the testimonies there, or perhaps, and I hope you don't, but perhaps you would be able to contribute to it too if you have endured something. You're listening to Woman's Hour. Good morning. And there are an enormous number of clichés surrounding French women and how they live their lives. So they don't get fat, we're always told that. They just know what to do with a scarf, don't they? They always look incredibly chic, and they're able to entertain lovers well into their 40th decade over very long lunches on the Champs-Élysées. The rest of France doesn't really exist when it comes to French clichés. It's all about Paris, really, isn't it? You and I, well, we're home alone in elasticated waist trousers eating a big box of Twiglets, but we're not French, or most of us aren't. So let's talk to Alice Pfeiffer, who is the author of a book called Je ne suis pas parisienne. She was born in Paris, educated in England. You don't actually have any... Do you have any French blood, Alice?
No, not at all. No, both my parents are foreign, but my mother grew up in London and my father in Austria, and they met in Paris.
Right, okay.
But I'm technically Parisienne, though, because I grew up to the age 15. I had school 3 minutes away from the Eiffel Tower, so I technically count, but I don't identify to her in any way.
Oh, no, look, that'll do for me. So you really have had loads of long lunches on the Champs-Élysées, then?
Definitely.
Have you?
No lover, but yes.
Okay. So this idea of French women, how much of a problem is it if you don't actually like the idea very much, or you don't want to be a part of all the clichés surrounding it?
I think the issue with the cliché is what it says between the lines, you know. So supposedly it's a very free look that can be adapted to everyone. It's a philosophy of life, but if you have a closer look, it's basically a skinny woman who wears what they call a boyfriend shirt. So she's petite and she's also heterosexual, and she wears stiletto heels by the Eiffel Tower before seeing her lover. So she only commutes in small distances and probably doesn't use public transport.
Right.
You know, she wears red lipstick or doesn't touch her hair. She's probably white, because the rouge parisien, as we call it, Parisian red, only works with the limited skin tones. And so it's if you look closer, basically what you see is a straight, bourgeois, heterosexual white woman who supposedly speaks for the whole of France, even though we're a highly diverse country. This is the only face we see, and we just... and then there's no room for anyone else.
You're right, of course. It is a much more diverse country than that cliché would have you believe. I think you would also say, to a degree, it supports the patriarchy. Can you just expand on that?
There's the idea of the male gaze, I think, we're unlike Britain, we're a country that's highly macho, and we're Catholic supposedly not, but we're still very much a Catholic country.
Officially secular, but
in the norms and in the interactions, we're very macho. And there's a myth of the bohemian artist like Serge Gainsbourg, who's extremely macho. So it's all codes to fit a macho behavior for men. So it's the idea of a woman who's lighter, who's more petite, who's extremely seductive, and which is completely anti-feminist if you think about it. So it's a woman waiting for a man to you know, make a move, essentially.
And you have challenged this to a great extent, actually. What kind of reaction have you had?
Oh, the reactions were good, I think. So far, so good, touch wood. I think it was directly addressed at all French women, so... So I think women were happy to see something that finally calls out a cliche that's absolutely everywhere, that's in every advertising you can see, every ad perfume you can see, to sell absolutely anything from Eurostar tickets to, yes, to you know, to tissues to luxury. So I think most people feel like a cheat when you, even though you might be from Paris, and if you don't come from Paris, it's even tougher. So I think people were relieved to see something that calls out a really dangerous process.
Well, I don't think it was that long ago we featured it on this program, actually. The incident of harassment, a young woman who was, well, she didn't really pay sufficient attention, or that was what he felt, to a man who fancied her. Just to remind people of what happened there.
Didn't he? He walked past a woman in a terrace of a coffee shop and tried to hit on her. She didn't react, or she sort of pushed him away. And then he just slapped her and started hitting her. And then she created the movement. Was it Balance Ton Port? She basically created a structure for women to call out street harassment. But what happened was that a gang of privileged women who were exactly like Parisienne all signed a petition called Le droit d'être importuné, so the right to be bothered by men,
yes,
because they thought it was a beautiful tradition that needs to be kept.
Yes, I do remember that, and that was deeply unfortunate, and I think involved quite a number of older celebrity French women, didn't
all
it?
All prominent, all white, all privileged. So there was definitely, for the first time, there was definitely like a fracture between women. Between the women who take public transport and who actually do suffer from men hitting on them, and then the tiny minority of women who speak for everyone else.
Why don't you come and live here?
I might. And then become a Parisienne and be, yes, perfectly obnoxious about it.
Yes. Well, I mean, the trouble, you seem to think that Britain is better. I don't know. Are you convinced it really is?
I think in terms of seduction and in terms of men-women relationship, I think it's you see a lot more diversity in bodies. You see a lot less harassment or street commenting. In France, there's a proximity that you have from being a Latin and a Mediterranean country. So men will actively comment on your appearance in the street. In my book, I tell the story of when I came back from 10 years in England and I ordered a pint and fries, the British diet. And the waiter told me off because he told me it would make me fat. And so
sorry.
Okay,
let me just stop you there. You are a grown woman ordering,
yes,
a pint and some chips.
Yes.
And a man thought it was okay to challenge that.
I wanted a second serving and he just said,
oh,
no, I'm with him now.
Oh, you wanted two helpings.
Yeah. Exactly. See, all my fault. And he just tapped on his hips and said, oh, mademoiselle, you'll scare all the men away. So I think in regards to Britain, I'm not saying it's perfect, but at least there's less pressure put on women by men actively and shamelessly. Remember, we come from a tradition of Serge Gainsbourg, who recorded all sort of naughty stuff. But I think the figure of the artist and the bohemian passion is less present. Remember, we still have a term called crime passionnel, crime of passion, and that is if you hit your spouse out of fashion.
And so, that is still a legal term.
Definitely, absolutely. And it's seen as an excuse if anything happens to a woman that you can perfectly use in court. So, Britain is a little bit calmer when it comes to accepting other women's bodies. You see a lot more different bodies in the street.
I mean, I have been I love France. And in the south of France, I have to say that women aren't necessarily, any more than I am, they're not stick thin.
Because Paris and France, like you were saying, are two different things.
Two different things, okay. Yeah.
You know, if you come to Marseille, there's a completely different kind of womanhood because they live by the beach, because of a million different factors. So I think the aim of the book was to remind people that we're a highly centralized country, but there's activities and people and culture and things happening around the country. And yet when you look up or you read any of the literature that's been written about French women, that it always means Parisienne and nothing else.
Well, you're doing your level best, Alice, to put that right. Thank you very much indeed for talking
to us.
Thank you. Alice Pfeiffer. Let's hear it for Britain, the country where a woman is free to drink pints and eat loads of chips. Now, later in the week, we're discussing cryptocurrency. You may, and if you haven't heard it, you should. You may have heard of the BBC Sounds podcast, The Missing Crypto Queen. It's all about a mysterious figure, Dr. Ruja Ignatova, who persuaded millions to join her financial revolution. Well, she said it was one. Then she disappeared. We're going to be discussing The Missing Crypto Queen in all her, well, glory isn't quite the right word, on Thursday's edition of Woman's Hour. It is interesting stuff that if you know nothing about cryptocurrency, we'll tell you all you need to know later on this week on the programme. Now to the new film Judy and Punch. It's a very dark fairy tale, this, directed by Mira Folks, that turns that familiar, if somewhat sinister, seaside entertainment on its head. Mia Wasikowska plays puppeteer Judy, Damon Herriman is Punch, and they live in the landlocked town of Seaside, a violent, lawless place overrun by witch hunts and hangings. It's all very creepy. And I put it to the director, Mira, that this was exactly what she wanted my reaction to be.
I mean, yes, I think it should be deeply unsettling. I find it really exciting and interesting that people are coming out of the film with very different, diverse reactions, and that was the intention when I made the movie.
Sit down! The show is about to begin!
And Mia, when you first saw the script of Judy and Punch, what did you make of this? Because you must get sent stuff all the time.
Yeah, I was just really excited about how original it was. I remember reading that first speech of Punch's and just being like, I don't know what, is this a language I don't know? Like, it was very rhymey, limerick kind of... I just loved how much creative license there was.
You've heard the talk from far and wide of Punch's puppet play. Best in the world, the greatest show, is what the critics say. The congregations of St. Paul's grow thinner every day. They're coming to the show of shows, not kneeling down to pray.
It's set in a place called Seaside, which you're at pains to point out is nowhere near the sea. Mm. I couldn't place it in time, but that doesn't matter either, because this is, unfortunately, it's a perennial. Domestic abuse is something that's gone on throughout time. Everywhere in the world. Why did you want to make Punch and Judy, Judy and Punch in this film, the centre of your film?
I started to sort of do a deep dive into the history of Punch and Judy from Commedia dell'arte right through to it being anglicised here in the UK.
Sorry, Commedia, that's the Italian...
Yeah, it comes from Italian puppetry, Commedia dell'arte, and then all of those characters with kind of anglicised and Punchinello turned into Punch, and that's the sort of history. And then I was also very curious about what I saw as this strange kind of devolution from quite beautiful marionettes to this very sort of simple hand puppet show that is really quite violent and deals with this kind of heavy domestic abuse. And I was kind of fascinated that this story is still really popular today and we continue to kind of tell it and show it and treasure it, but I hadn't seen anyone digging into the sort of scarier elements and politics of that.
I grew up in Britain and Punch and Judy was a sort of, I didn't think, until I saw the film actually, I hadn't really questioned it. Now I'm really uneasy about the fact that Punch and Judy was served up to children for apparently forever without anybody asking too many questions. Did you see it, Mia, as a kid?
I don't think I actually saw a Punch and Judy, but I've definitely had an awareness of it. I thought similarly. I mean, that footage at the end of the movie is from, like, Bondi Junction. Or is that right? Or,
yeah, I think yeah, it's from Australia, the archival footage that plays over the credits
yeah,
of these
just
kids.
Explain what it is.
So it's these children that are watching a Punch and Judy show, and it plays mainly on their faces. And basically in that moment, it's all about the dichotomy that I was interested in, this kind of very strange combination between laughter and fear. We don't know whether we're excited and elated by something or whether it's terrifying. And so I think that's what the film that we made is really sort of setting out to explore.
Mia, in your role, you are Judy, who is the brains of Judy and Punch. You're much better
at the puppetry than Punch is. Mm. And that really annoys him, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think he definitely probably knows that she's the one with the talent. I mean, you see it kind of fall out in his next relationship. Yeah, I think he definitely is probably aware of her gift and is sort of trying to possess it and then take credit for it or something. But you can see she's the one that's really behind the show.
We don't want to give too much of the plot away, but right. you do emerge victorious, it would be fair to say, although it's not easy, your path through the film.
Yes. Well, tragedy befalls, and then Judy kind of has to, I guess, build herself back up completely from scratch without this family. And, yeah, I guess the movie sort of tracks her re-establishing a sense of self and strength and then kind of coming back to teach Punch a lesson.
And boy, does he get a lesson.
Yes.
It's all about the triumph of outsiders as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because there are always outsiders wherever we live. What would you say about that element of the film?
Well, that's probably one of my favourite parts of the movie. I mean, the speech that Judy gives at the end about today, the witch is me, and I think you all know it could be you tomorrow, it really points out how easy it is to sort of stay in the comfort of that mob, but, you know, while you are, you're also sort of living in fear of being the one up on the stand. And I just think you can see that all over the world now and probably always.
It's certainly true that throughout history, clever women have been thought of as very dangerous indeed.
And I mean, there's this a whole suspicion about Judy and that little warning she gets about not taking her magic tricks too far because it could, arouse too much suspicion.
All right, run along now. That's enough.
Oh, good day, Judy.
Constable.
A wonderful show last night. Wonderful. You really have your way with the puppets. You really have your way with the puppets.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Just one word, Judy. You might wish to keep those magic tricks a little on the low down. So convincing they are, they'll be taken for sorcery, and the last thing I would like to see is a woman such as yourself before the stoners. Seems some folk in Seaside are prone to superstition. More and more by the day, it would appear.
What do you want people to take away from this? It's more than just questioning the idea of this slightly dodgy puppet show, isn't it?
Mm. For me, I think it's really fascinating the time we're in where we can re-examine and look at these myths or stories or fables that we hand down throughout generations and see them from a different perspective. And that doesn't mean that I am trying to be sort of the PC police and saying this shouldn't exist, has no relevance. But I think it's really interesting when you come back to these traditional stories and just have a look at what it says about us historically and culturally and politically. I did very much want all of those contemporary allegories to come through with the film. So I hope that there's stuff in there that people recognise as current dilemmas or truths or thematics. Unfortunately, there's a little more in there that I would like that's currently still sort of familiar and recognisable.
Mia, I've read that you make what some people regard as quirky choices for your film roles. And I guess you could say that Judy and Punch was also another quirky choice. Mm. Are you conscious of that? Is that what you're doing?
I don't know. I think it's always sort of funny to see your choices viewed by somebody else and then you're like, oh, okay. I feel like all the choices I've made are like completely obvious and exactly what everybody else would do if they were in my shoes.
The films I've seen you in, remember Jane Eyre and Alice in Wonderland, which is the ultimate cinematic trip by most people's standards. Could you ever see yourself in the bog standard rom-com, slightly ditzy, you know, meet a man, all goes a bit pear-shaped, a bit more goes wrong and then it gets happy? Is that not something you'd ever want to do?
A few years ago, I probably would have been like, I will never do that. But, I'm sure my mother would love me to do something like a little bit more like friendly to, you know, grandmas, especially mine. But I don't know. I would never say never. There's some rom-coms I think are brilliant.
Name your favourite.
Really like One Fine Day.
Who's that?
It's Michelle Pfeiffer and George Clooney. It's quite an old one and they've got the two little kids and they're really cranky, but it's such a good one. Yeah, so there's some that I think are brilliant, but I mean, I actually never get offered them, so I probably won't.
Yeah.
No, please, no. I also think they're really hard to make and make well, and often on returning to look at some of my favourite rom-coms, I'm like, oh, this is a problem. not sure that I can show that to my niece or, you know. Like,
right, because we start reassessing things.
Yeah.
And realise, yeah. No, it's not.
Yeah, totally. I mean, even found that recently with a movie that I used to love as a teenager. Is it bad to name them?
No, it's fine.
Princess Diaries, but it was great. And I loved it. But, like, then I was watching it with my niece, and me and my sister sort of looked at each other and sort of were like, oh, I think we should turn this off, just because there's a very, like, external view. I mean, she's, like, so cute at the beginning with her big afro and her eyebrows, and it just felt a bit strange to me.
And then she's turned into this.
Straightened and beautified, and you do sort of like look at things differently, I think.
Yeah, no, you do. And so let's hear it for Quirk, basically. So what's your next project, Mira?
I don't know, actually. Maybe a rom-com.
Starring Mia,
yeah.
That's the film director Mira Fox, and you also heard from the actress Mia Wasikowska. And I can recommend that film. It's not for everybody. It's a little bit sinister in places, but it's very challenging. Judy and Punch, it's out November the 22nd. That's this Friday, and it's Certificate 15. Now, Lady Glenconner is here. Welcome to the programme. Good morning to you.
Hello, good morning.
We've just been chatting for the last 10 minutes or so, and we've already determined we will not get through all your anecdotes in the amount of time available.
Well, I've got an awful lot, we'll do our best.
We're going to have a very good try. Now, yes. Just so people know about you, you grew up in Norfolk on one of the largest estates in England. Your father was the Earl of Leicester, a maid of honour at the coronation, lady-in-waiting to Princess Margaret, married to the eccentric Colin Tennant, who bought Mustique and turned it into a very exclusive party island for the rich and famous. And she's written a memoir called Lady-in-Waiting, My Extraordinary Life in the Shadow of the Crown. You're from the Cook family, that's how I pronounce it, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's spelt Coke, but you pronounce it Cook.
Yes, yeah. I can't bet these aristocratic confusions.
Well, it is always very difficult, I know. Especially when I go to America, they find that very difficult.
Well, I can't say I blame them. The family crest features an ostrich swallowing an iron horseshoe.
Yes, because my ancestor was a lawyer, the great who prosecuted Guy Fawkes, and that meant that he could digest anything, which I imagine he did. They were terrifying judges in those days.
Yes.
In their black caps.
Yes, and that was your, what, great-great-great
something? Oh, great-great, yes, a long time ago.
Actually, though...
Elizabeth, yes, during the reign of...
The Tudors.
Exactly, and Queen Elizabeth I. Yes.
Now, the early part of the book is devoted to your extraordinary childhood on this country estate in Norfolk. There are some wonderful nuggets here of aristocratic life. I particularly enjoyed the idea of a special beach house for ladies.
Oh, yes, that's a meal house, and it... And all my female relations used to go down there and have what they call no stays week, where they took off their stays and wore something loose. Because the thing was that life at Holcombe was very, very formal. And it was a very male-orientated house. And the women, I think, didn't play a great part compared to the men. And they were always upholstered in their stays. So to go down to the meal house and have no stays week, and they used to wander on the beach, must have been absolutely lovely.
So you could whip off your corset and what, go skinny dipping?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I remember I'm quite old, I'm 87 now, but I remember wearing some terrible thing called a roll-on, and it was meant to roll down, but it was always rolling up and getting very uncomfortable. Right. And one's stockings were sort of, one has suspenders on it.
Now, you say it was a male environment. You actually, your birth was regarded by some as a disappointment because you weren't a boy.
Well, I know. I've got this photograph at my christening. My father's holding me, and I've got my grandfather one side, my great-grandfather the other. They're all looking frightfully gloomy because I was a girl. I did my best to be a boy. I weighed 11 pounds, nearly killed my mother.
Yes.
And then this huge girl arrived. But yes. Anyway, there's nothing I could do about it.
Well, that explains why, you didn't inherit the estate, did you?
No, nothing.
No, and
nothing.
It went in the end to your...
Well, a cousin who'd been brought up in South Africa, my father asked him to come over when he realised he wasn't going to have a son. And Eddie arrived and actually was charming to my mother. And I have two sisters too.
You were
But you grew up around the royal family to an extent, and I think Princess Margaret and the then Princess Elizabeth came to play.
Yes, because Sandringham is quite near, it's only 10 miles away. And my father was an equerry to the Duke of York before he became king. He was equerry to him during the time of the abdication, which is very interesting. And so they used to come over to Holkham, and I got a wonderful photograph of us all standing, and Princess Margaret sort of looking at my feet. And I remember saying to her once, "Ma'am, I've just found this photograph. Why are you looking at my feet?" Well, she said, "Anne, you've got silver shoes. I'm so jealous. I only have brown ones." And the Queen's looking actually as if Princess Margaret's up to no good. But we had, used to have a wonderful time because I remember Princess Margaret and I used to have little tricycles. And we used to go round and round all the passages at Holkham. And occasionally the Queen would say, "What are you doing? You mustn't do that," you know. But Princess Margaret was the best sort of friend one could possibly have. She's quite naughty.
Well, indeed. You were extremely loyal to her. You're still very loyal to her. Not everybody is very nice about Princess Margaret. I have to say, this book is full of stories that show her in a rather positive light.
Well, I think that's what I hope to achieve. Because I'm so sort of sad and cross, really, with all the things that were written about her after she died by people who hadn't even met her. And a lot of the things they said were quite untrue.
She was a demanding lady, though.
Well, I didn't find her like that. I mean, she was a wonderful, wonderful friend to me. And if you sort of asked her what she would like to do, you know, and she loved doing very simple things. I mean, she always used to arrive to stay with me in my very small house in Norfolk with our marigold gloves and I think your car needs cleaning, and she'd clean my car. She always did my fires because she'd been a girl guide and I hadn't.
She did struggle with a kettle, I think, on one occasion.
Well, she did. I mean, the thing was that I used to make breakfast for her and carry it up, and she'd ride with her kettle and said, "I'm going to be completely, you just give me the tea and the milk and I won't be a bother to you." Mm. Well, I was sort of down in the kitchen and suddenly I heard, "Anne." And I said, "Yes, ma'am, what do you want?" Well, she said, "Something the matter with my kettle, it won't work." And of course, she absolutely no idea, I had to turn it on. Yes. So in the end, I always used to bring her breakfast up myself.
There are some lovely stories in the book towards the end of her life, actually, when I suppose her social life had dwindled and you were still very much a part of it, though, and you would go and read to her. But unfortunately, she was keen at the time on some very boring books. There was one about seeds.
Most deadly book about seeds. But the trouble was that Roddy had given it.
This is Roddy Llewellyn.
Llewellyn. Yeah. And I remember getting as far as a chapter on potatoes. And I said to her, "Ma'am, this is the most boring book I've ever read. I mean, wouldn't you like to choose something else?" And she said, "Not a bit. It's absolutely fascinating. Carry on." So I carried on.
I want to talk about your marriage because Colin Tennant, the man you married, I don't know how to sum him up. Eccentric isn't enough, is it? It's an adjective that simply doesn't do the man justice.
Well, he was a man of many parts. He was so many different things. He was fascinating, most wonderful storyteller, terrible temper, impossible, really, in lots of ways.
Banned from British Airways.
Well, there was a lovely story in British Airways. Well, the point about it is, which was that I was in waiting to Princess Margaret. And when you're in waiting, you can't leave her. And for some reason, Princess Margaret and I were in first class, and Colin, they simply didn't have a seat near us. And so he was taken off down the end of the aeroplane, and suddenly the most ghastly noise. And I thought, oh, Christ, Colin's having a tantrum.
Well, Colin, how old was Colin at this point?
I think nearly 60.
Carry on.
Anyway, what had happened was he just was lying down in the aisle, screaming. And so I got up to see him. Princess Margaret said, "No, sit down, Anne." And to my absolute horror, I looked out of the window and there he was being dragged off the aeroplane by two huge American cops and shouting, "Anne, help, Anne." And I said, "Ma'am, I must go." And Princess Margaret said, "Sit down, take absolutely no notice." that's what happened. I sat down and took absolutely no notice. They arrived back 3 days later and nothing more was said.
No, I mean, it is remarkable. To put people in the picture here, this is a man who would routinely move house every 5 minutes. I don't know how you put up with that. He went through a phase of eating only from paper bags. At one point, he was eating his own pants.
He had this trick. He had paper pants on. And he used to say as a sort of fun thing, I suppose. I didn't think it very funny. I'm going to eat my knickers now. And he pushed his hand down, take the paper knickers out and stuff them in his mouth. Anyway, that was one of his sort of party tricks.
You stayed with him. How long were you married?
54 years. I did have one moment very soon after I married him when I went back to see my mother at Holcombe. And I said, Mum, I'm not quite sure whether I can cope. And you see, in those days, she turned to me and she said, you married him, you go straight back. And I did. For another 54 years.
This was after, yes, I mean, you're right, that would have been the advice at the time, wouldn't it?
Well, I was having Charlie, our eldest son.
You were already pregnant,
you
yes.
know, and I stayed and for the children, and that's what we did, you yes. know.
Was it the right thing to do you think?
Well, I think it was probably, yes, for me. I mean, you always think the grass is going to be greener somewhere else, and quite often it isn't. And there were a great many wonderful things about Colin. I was never bored.
No, okay. I should say there is a lot of levity in the book and there are some wonderful memories, but you've known such sadness. You've had three sons, one of whom had a terrible accident and brilliantly survived it, but you've lost two, and Henry and Charles, your eldest child.
Yes, I mean, I lost Charlie, the eldest one, because he was a drug addict for a time, and then he did recover, but I'm afraid his body had been so damaged that he did die in the end. But the most sort of really terrifying was Henry, my second son, who was married and had a lovely son called Ewan, and I've now got two great grandchildren by him. So, but anyway, Henry decided to be gay, and at that time it was extremely frightening because we didn't know how AIDS was caught. And, of course, he then got AIDS and, one's friends suddenly wouldn't come and stay. I don't blame them. They had children.
This is
and
in the 1980s.
Didn't know her. But Princess Margaret always came.
Right.
She brought her children. When she saw Henry, she hugged him. And she used to come with me to the Lighthouse, which was a place in London for young men, who.
Yes.
She wasn't touchy-feely like the Princess of Wales, but we used to go into their room. She'd make them laugh. She'd tell stories. And she made them forget for a moment, how ill they were. But she did a lot of those sort of things, Princess Margaret, people didn't really know about.
There isn't an ounce in this book of self-pity, actually, which I think is one of the reasons why people have praised it, because you have known terrible suffering and you just get on with it, don't you? You really are a stoic.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, I've got my faith. I'm a Christian. And I think that's what Christians do. You're given your hand. In some ways, I always felt that God had felt I was strong enough to cope. I mean, I always thank God it wasn't my second sister, who I don't think could have coped. She's sadly died now. I did get it. I was brought up. We were brought up in the war when people always say, what a privileged life you've led, Anne. And I say, well, I'm not very privileged during the war. My parents were in Egypt. I had a governess at one point who was very unkind to me.
Yes.
We were hungry at boarding school. We were always hungry, always cold. Now when people say, what do you do? I say, I've never been so happy. I just really enjoy life. When things go right, then you should really, make the most of it.
Has the Queen read this book?
I'm not sure.
Might you give it to her?
I thought I might send her one for Christmas. I think Prince Charles has, and the Duchess of Cornwall.
Right. Well.
In my book, I'm nothing but I've so fond of them all, and I think I put a very positive light.
That is Lady Glenconner, Anne Glenconner. The book is Lady in Waiting. And actually, if the Queen does need cheering up, and I suspect she might need cheering up right now, I hope she does get Anne's book for Christmas, because although it isn't all laughter. Far from it, in fact. There are some very funny stories in that book, including we didn't have time for the time she went to Russia with a dear friend, and the friend didn't rate Russian cuisine very much, so decided the best way to handle it was to go with an enormous leg of Parma ham. What happened to the Parma ham is in the book, but it's quite funny. Right, to your thoughts on everything else on the programme today. The first conversation we had about the victims of Jeffrey Epstein and the danger, in fact, that they have been forgotten, or well, hopefully they won't be forgotten, but they certainly appear to have been lost in the conversational mix over the last couple of days. This listener says, listening to Madeleine Black on Woman's Hour, the shame is not ours. Absolutely, the shame belongs always to the perpetrators and to the people who try to shame and blame the victims. From Sarah, thank God Woman's Hour are talking about the victims of abuse. We need to listen to them. And from Catherine, this is on the subject of French women. I've lived in rural France for 6 years, so I can't speak for French cities. As far as keeping their figures, the French grow their own veg, shop carefully, eat less but better, drink wine regularly but in moderation. Natural raw ingredients are important and foraging is very popular. They also sit at the table for every meal. Food has a very important place in the day. Older people are well looked after. And every village has a troisième age group who meet together and socialise. I suppose, is that like the University of the Third Age or so? I suppose, sounds a good idea anyway. However, says Catherine, French women do not have it all. Out here in the country, it's still a rather male-dominated environment with traditional roles. From Gilly, we've lived in France for 12 years. I haven't seen any glamorous women, much to my husband's disappointment. In fact, I've been flattered by my dress sense by the French where we live. Well done, you. Excellent, Gilly. Flying the flag. Amanda, I've just got back from a weekend in Paris. I'm 57 and when younger used to travel to France on business. I always felt so intimidated by the elegance of French women, but on our recent trip, my partner and I agreed that the younger generation look exactly like any other women in Europe. Also, I'd never seen large groups of French women eating out together. This time there were lots of girls' nights out and mixed large groups, so much more relaxed and people having more fun. Isn't that interesting? I suppose I hadn't thought about whether large groups of French women would eat out together. Honestly, how long has it been since large groups of British women went out together? I suppose women have always socialised with each other, but I think it's probably relatively recent even here that large groups of women have gone out to eat and drink together. I don't know. I'll see what people say about that. Martina, fat Irish woman visits Paris, is the headline on her email. I'm now feeling particularly apprehensive about my trip to Paris next February. As we hope it all will be, as a 58-year-old fat Irish woman, will I have to face a barrage of fat shaming on the streets of Paris? All one-liner comebacks in French gratefully received. I'm sure, Martina, don't worry about it. For heaven's sake, I very much doubt you'll face anything. Nor should you, by the way, and I hope you have a lovely time when you go. From Jill, I've lived in La France Profonde for 17 years, and I think this is like the swinging 60s, which only happened in the King's Road. That's in London. The women I see are no more fashionable than British women, and there are certainly fat ones, unless they eat nothing, which I suspect some do. Yes, now that I do agree with. I can speak honestly as a woman who has never forgotten to eat, unless I'm very poorly, which unfortunately for me I haven't ever really been for very long. And from Richard, my observation as an Englishman is that when you go to France, Italy or Spain, the women dress in a manner that looks curiously more sophisticated than their contemporaries in the UK. They don't appear to spend massive amounts on clothes, but seem to have the panache and fit it all together in a better and more fashionable way. British women, unfortunately, don't have the sophisticated approach to fashion. Sad but true, says Richard, who I'm afraid doesn't include a photograph, so I am not in a position to gauge whether he is sartorially up to snuff. But Richard, if you could you send us... So, I mean, we can't say that about British women without providing us with evidence of your own fashion brilliance, I'm afraid. But anyway, you've been on the Woman's Hour podcast, so well done you. Thank you to everybody who took part. The programme and the pod are back tomorrow.
What is wellness?
I think of the image of wellness as like pure joy.
The important thing is for people to choose, like, what do you want to do?
Wellness are the things your grandmother told you to do.
When you really start to think about it, the answer feels more complicated. I'm Maya Feller, registered dietitian nutritionist and author.
And I'm Dr. Kavita Patel. We're the hosts of Well Now, Slate's new podcast on wellness.
Join us every Wednesday as we tackle that simple yet important question, what does it mean to be well?